Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. On Sunday, an estimated 3 million people took part in more than 100 protests across Brazil. People are calling for the impeachment of President Dilma Rousseff and for the imprisonment of former President Lula da Silva. The country's top newspapers said these were the largest political demonstrations in the country's history. Joining us to discuss coverage is Will Carlos, senior correspondent for Global Post, based in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Hi, Will. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks. It's always a pleasure.
It's always nice to have you. And on the domestic front, we are continuing our coverage of the elections. Now that Donald Trump will most likely be the Republican nominee, how should the independent media cover him? We have been asking ourselves this question for the past few months. Joining us to discuss coverage of the election and to help us answer that question is Will Bunch, an award-winning senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News and author of the new ebook, The Burn Identity, A Search for Bernie Sanders and the New American Dream. And Will has been extensively covering the election for the Philadelphia Daily News, and he joins us from Philadelphia. Hi, Will. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And Andrew Coburn is Washington editor of Harper's Magazine and author of Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. Andrew's latest piece for Harper's is called Down the Tube, Television, Turnout, and the Election Industrial Complex. He points out that the 2012 election generated about $7 billion for this massive industry of strategists, pollsters, TV ad makers, media buyers, broadcasters, and of course, 2016 will probably be much higher than that $7 billion, and we'll talk about where all that money is going. Hi, Andrew. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Great to be with you.
Great to have you. So as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight good reporting this week. So let's start with you, Will Bunch. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Yeah, actually, a piece that just came out last night, and I really think it's a must-read piece for people who've been following the Democratic primaries this year, and hold on, because I want to get the title exactly right. It's called What Bernie Sanders Achieved, and it's on the New Yorker website, NewYorker.com, written by one of their staff writers, Don Sanders, and I really think he does a great job in finding if you're a Bernie Sanders supporter, I know it hasn't been the greatest week. You know, he went 0-for-5 in the primaries on Tuesday, and that was disillusioning to a lot of supporters. But I think he really lays out the ways in which Bernie Sanders has changed the political landscape in a positive way, you know, by making issues such as big money in politics and income inequality, you know, front burner issues, which they wouldn't have been really if he hadn't launched his campaign. You know, the way that he's brought in a lot of disillusioned people and a lot of young people into the political process, it really puts a positive spin going forward on what he's achieved and, you know, probably what he'll continue to achieve in the next couple months as he stays in the race.
Well, I'd love to talk about that later in the show because, Will, you wrote a new ebook about this issue, The Burn Identity. You spoke with a lot of Bernie supporters, and we are also going to talk about the fact that even though Bernie Sanders lost all five states on Tuesday, he spoke to supporters in Arizona on Super Tuesday for about an hour, but none of the networks carried his speech or even 30 seconds of it. They did carry everyone else's, so we'll also talk about that later. So kudos to The New Yorker's Don Sanders for this piece, What Bernie Sanders Achieved. Thanks for that. That's Will Bunch. He's with the Philadelphia Daily News. And what about you, Andrew? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I saw this it's a week ago now, but I thought Jeffrey Goldberg's piece on the so-called Obama doctrine was completely fascinating. I mean, I don't think much of Jeffrey Goldberg normally, that much of the Atlantic, you know, but I thought this was riveting stuff, that the here you have the President of the United States. I mean, it's very revealing. He was revealing, well, he's really taking a tremendous dig at Hillary Clinton, you know. I mean, she was positioned as the warmongering, sort of the warmonger in his cabinet as opposed to his sage and Pacific intentions. John Kerry, nothing but rude words for the Saudis, the Israelis, Bibi Netanyahu to extend, the British. I thought it was astonishing. I've never read anything like it. That particularly his his vehemence against the Saudis was obviously very cheering. And it was also very revealing overall about Obama. I mean, who's been president for the last 7 years? And yet here he is sort of, you know, complaining about all his allies. I thought it would give us much to reflect on about what kind of a president he is and what he thinks of his closest allies. Hmm. So, I mean, it sort of really sort of rocked Washington, I can tell you, and caused a great deal of heartburn among in Saudi Arabia and nearby, which is also very cheering as well.
How did it rock Washington?
Well, everyone was sort of astonished that that he would say these things, and people were trying to spin. I mean, I heard sort of people who, like, are paid by the Saudis to sort of advance their cause, trying to put a spin on it. The Israelis, the British. He had to walk back the comments about David Cameron, the British Prime Minister. There was obviously a very angry phone call from Downing Street about that.
What did he say about Cameron?
Well, he said that Cameron had sort of egged him on to intervene in Libya, and then it kind of lost interest and left him holding the bag, which is, probably true. But, I mean, Obama didn't have to go into Libya. I mean, I should say that, one of his chief, he says what a big mistake it was to intervene in Libya, and implicitly blames Hillary Clinton for that, which I thought was pretty interesting. So he's setting out, it's his plan for his legacy as a sort of wise Pacific president, as opposed to the warmongers who came before and probably after him.
So overall, Andrew, do you think Jeffrey Goldberg asked good questions?
Well, he just sort of showed, 90% of life is showing up. He just sort of hung around and has somehow ingratiated himself with the chief executive. I think his prejudices are pretty clear. And, of course, he's never, whereas poor old Judy Miller was hauled over the coast, forever for having got us into the Iraq War all on her own. No one, the New Yorker and Jeffrey Goldberg, have never apologized for an incredibly mendacious piece they ran back then, basically tying Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda together, which was a load of tripe, but that was quite important at the time. Having said all that, I have to commend Mr. Goldberg, former Israeli prison guard, for actually giving us this.
All right, so kudos to Jeffrey Goldberg with the
Atlantic.
Yeah, reluctantly, from Andrew Coburn. This piece is in The Atlantic, and you can find it online. It's The Obama Doctrine. Thank you for that one, Andrew. Andrew Coburn is Washington editor of Harper's Magazine. What about you, Will Carlos? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I'd like to bring some attention to the work of Stephanie Nolan. She's the reporter for the Globe and Mail, Canada's Globe and Mail, based here in Rio. I'm not sure how long she's been here. I've criticized a couple of her pieces in the past, but it's at a time of great chaos in Brazil where the story is sort of shifting almost by the hour, she's done a really fantastic job of keeping abreast of it. Not just keeping abreast of it, but doing, what we call in the journalism business, writing with authority. And one of the things that's really interesting in Brazil at the moment is the contrast between the way that the local media is covering the sort of the fast growing scandal and the way the international media is covering it. And I think right at the top of the pyramid there is Stephanie. She's doing great work. She has a piece, I think, that came out today that is called "Rousseff Backed into Corner as New Revelations Stir Turmoil in Brazil." That might sound like a bit of a mouthful of a headline, but honestly, given the complications of what's going on, that's pretty good.
All right, so kudos to Stephanie Nolan with the Globe and Mail. That is Will Carlos. He's senior correspondent for the Global Post. He's based in Rio, and we will put links to all of these articles at yourcallradio.org. So let's dive in and talk about Brazil, Will. As you said, things are changing by the hour. So give us an update. What is the latest?
Oh, how long have I got? Because it's been a long and crazy week. I'll give you the highlights. I mean, basically, last week you had Lula, the former president of Brazil, one of the most charismatic politicians to ever, rule in South America, still pretty popular in Brazil, although his popularity is probably waning by the minute. He was called in for questioning as part of this massive scandal, what is known as the car wash or Petrobras scandal. He was called in sent for questioning. A few days later, he was actually charged by a separate group of prosecutors in the state of São Paulo with money laundering in connection to some property he owned. What happened next was that you start to hear rumblings that Lula is going to be made a minister, a member of the current president's cabinet. And that's extremely important because in Brazil there is a very strong system of parliamentary immunity. So around 700 or so elected officials in Brazil have very, very strong immunity. They cannot be prosecuted in the regular courts. You basically have to prosecute them through the Supreme Court. So, as this was happening, as Lula was about to be made a minister and given all of this protection, the judge who is overseeing the big corruption scandal leaked a number of very interesting phone calls, recordings of phone calls, which were secretly wiretapped. They actually wiretapped, you know, the former president's phone. So it's pretty extraordinary. This is as if a group of prosecutors had gone out and sort of recorded conversations between, say, Clinton and Obama. That's what we're dealing with here. These recordings, the judge purported, argued that they showed that Lula was really just trying to get protection. He wasn't really interested in the cabinet post, and he was just trying to get in there to protect himself from prosecution. The government argued, no, that's not what he's doing at all. He ended up being named a minister yesterday at a ceremony in Brasilia. And immediately, as soon as he was made a minister, a judge in Brasilia put out a ruling that he was nullifying that move. And literally, I just had lunch with a guy with a PhD in political science. I said, hey, what's going on? Is he currently a minister or not? He said, I really don't know. So there's a lot of confusion in Brazil. It's moving very quickly, but that's, I think, the best recap I can do of where we are today.
You know, thank you. That was a very good recap. I mean, what has been the reaction to what has been happening with former President Lula da Silva? Because he was such a popular figure in Brazil.
He was. And so you're seeing it. I'm actually at the side of the road right now on my way to try and find a protest. There are supposedly going to be massive protests across Brazil, although I can't seem to find one in Rio. It's a beautiful day here. I think everybody's just sort of staring if they could go to the beach instead. But there have been enormous protests, as you mentioned in your intro, big protests back on Sunday. The protests are going to continue. People are very, very angry. I mean, they're very angry at a system of corruption. The economy is doing appallingly here. You've got other issues like the Zika crisis, which of course isn't the government's fault, but you know, the country's under a huge amount of strain, and people are showing it by getting out onto the streets. And both I think the biggest protests have certainly been anti-government, but you're also seeing the people on the left, the trade unions, you know, sort of, I guess it's fair to say, poorer people in society, starting to come out in greater numbers in support of the president. So a huge amount of street protests, and I think that's just going to continue.
Will Carlos is senior correspondent for Global Post. He is based in Rio, covering this massive anti-government scandal or protest as a result of the government scandal in Brazil. Last weekend, 3 million people took part in more than 100 protests across Brazil, and they have been continuing throughout the week. And if you have any questions for Will about what's happening in Brazil, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Will Bunch, senior writer with the Philadelphia Daily News, and Andrew Coburn, Washington editor of Harper's Magazine. And Will and Andrew, I know both of you have been following this as citizens, but I'm wondering, do you have any questions for Will Carlos? Will, go ahead.
Yeah, it's Will Bunch here. What fascinates me about the situation in Brazil is, I mean, just in a couple short months, you know, the eyes of the world are going to be on Brazil for the Summer Olympics. What is the current thinking about whether this is going to have any impact on their ability to successfully pull off that event? Because, the timing on this is truly, truly incredible from a global point of view.
Shall I jump right in?
Yes, please.
Thank you very much for asking that, because that's exactly the story that I pitched to my editor yesterday and I'm working on currently.
So the journalists all think alike, don't we? Yeah, we do.
And of course, you know, part of this is how do you make this story relevant to, and why should Americans care about this? And one of the big things on a lot of people's minds, you know, a lot of people might have tickets, might be planning a trip to Brazil. So the answer that I'm getting from everyone I've talked to so far, or I should say the few people I've talked to so far, is Brazil's not going to fall apart as a result of this. Brazil has very strong institutions that nobody seems to think that there's actually seriously going to be a military coup, which would be the sort of the main thing that people would worry about. The feeling here is that the institutions are strong. There is, I think the best way to describe it is that there's sort of a system for everything. So, I mean, if Dilma Rousseff, the current president, for example, if she is impeached tomorrow or next week, then her vice president takes over. If instead they force an election, then an election happens. You know, so there is a sort of an escape route for the country that doesn't end in chaos in all of these instances. And as far as, you know, how does it impact the Olympics going forwards? You know, Brazil is under so much stress. As I mentioned earlier, the economy, this problem with Zika, that they're pretty used to sort of getting on with it and trying to do the best job that they can. When I'm talking about the organizers of the Olympics, I don't really think that the sort of esoteric political shenanigans that are going on in Brasilia is going to have a huge amount of impact. The Olympics are largely a state-funded and state-managed event, so the state of Rio isn't being impacted particularly by what's going on in Brasilia. It will be long-term, of course, but over the next few months, I think it'll be largely business as usual.
And Andrew, do you have a question for Will?
Yeah, well, I'm just curious. Lula, I mean, he was kind of a hero to a lot of people, including, you know, obviously inside, but also outside Brazil. And it's kind of depressing. I mean, if there's merit, does sound up that there's some merit in the accusations against him. How did this happen? Was it just as the system inevitably corrupt people, even sort of decent people like him? Or, you know, do you have any idea why this came about?
Well, we should stress, of course, we've no idea whether or not he's committed any crimes. And I should also stress that really what he's been accused of is rather small potatoes when you look at the grand scale of this. I mean, at a time when I think something like 30 to 40% of the Brazilian legislators are currently under some form of criminal investigation. It's an extraordinary time, and it's an extraordinarily corrupt system. And it has really always been. I mean, going right back to the end of the dictatorship at the end of the 80s. So it is. I mean, it is sad. I mean, there's certainly, you know, a lot of people were bandying around a term which I guess gets bandied around too much, but I think it's probably fair in Brazil. A lot of people were talking about yesterday and the release of the recordings on Thursday being Brazil's Watergate. I mean, a real loss of innocence in a way. Not that Brazilians are under any illusions that their politicians aren't corrupt, but I think a lot of people thought that Lula was uncorruptible, that he wasn't in it for the money. And I think there's a lot of very disheartened people out there who see that you know, maybe it was all a charade after all, and that's been further eroded by the leaking of these really inflammatory phone calls, you know, where these politicians are talking to each other and effing and blinding and saying all sorts of nasty things about people. And it's really just been this sort of collective sort of sigh in Brazil of not only the loss of innocence of Lula or whatever shred of innocence he had left, but also just, you know, a real stripping bare of just how bad things have gotten and just how corrupt everybody seems to be.
And Will, independent journalist Julia Brossa had an op-ed in the New York Times, and she sees a silver lining to all of these scandals and turmoil. She believes that because the investigation has remained independent and unafraid to go after the country's most powerful politicians, it has emerged not as a tool for coup mongers, as some have charged, but as evidence of the country's maturing democracy. What are your thoughts on that?
Right. I admire Julia's work very much. She's somebody I follow very closely, and I had actually written a very similar story a few days earlier. You know, this is something a lot of people are talking about here. This idea that I think she's right. I mean, I think that what comes out of this is that the institutions of Brazil Should they survive this, and should people really be brought to justice, I think this sends a tremendous sign to future corrupt politicians that this sort of thing won't be tolerated. I mean, I grew up in Brazil. I lived here from in the 80s, from the age of 2 till 10. And when I left and as I followed Brazil, I it was always just taken as read that this was a country that's riddled with corruption, where everybody's on the take and nothing works officially. And I really think that we could be entering a new era as these people, as these people are raked out, as people are thrown in jail, as people are brought to justice, perhaps it ushers in a whole new load of leaders who are actually in it for the right reasons, aren't just looking to line their pockets, and maybe we enter a new phase in Brazil. I certainly hope so. I think a lot of people hope so, but there's still a lot of pain to come before that happens.
Will, before we let you go, you mentioned that the local coverage has been very different from the international coverage. Can you elaborate on that?
Certainly. The media in Brazil is dominated by, I mean, there's basically only one news channel in Brazil, TV channel, and that's Globo. And Globo, they're basically looking a lot like propaganda machines at the moment. So the most stark example is the fact that these recordings were released. And the key recording, the key wiretap is a conversation between former President Lula and current President Dilma, in which they appear to be discussing the terms or getting some paperwork to him so that he could become a minister. Now, all of the newspapers, pretty much all the coverage that I saw in the Brazilian media, immediately jumped to the conclusion that that meant that they were trying to arrange this behind the scenes so that he could get that immunity that I talked about earlier. A lot of very smart people in the international media sort of said, "Hey, wait a minute! It doesn't necessarily mean that." And if you actually drill into the words, it doesn't necessarily say that. So there was certainly a lot more caution from the international media. Stephanie Nolan, whose authoritative writing I mentioned earlier, she wrote in her story, "Look, there's nothing in that call that disproves the government line on this, the government excuse on this, and they could just be telling the truth." And I haven't seen anybody in the Brazilian media until actually today, I should say. Today there was an op-ed in Estadão, Folha de São Paulo, which is the big newspaper in São Paulo, that started to raise some questions. But it just looks like most of the media have taken a hook, line, and sinker and not really questioned the take that's been fed to them. Mm.
Well, we'll be following this, and we'd love to have you back. Will Carlos is senior correspondent for Global Post, based in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Will, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And coming up after a break, we'll continue our media roundtable with Will Bunch, senior writer with the Philadelphia Daily News, and Andrew Coburn, Washington editor of Harper's Magazine. We'll talk about money in politics, coverage of that, and ongoing coverage of the presidential election. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on local public radio, KALW San Francisco. If you'd like to add a perspective to today's discussion that we've not yet heard, or you have a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number. You can also send your question via email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post your comment at the same site, yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock, Lauren Schiller and Inflection Point, and following that at noon, the Tavis Smiley Show.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation with environmental journalist Jason Mark about his new book, Satellites in the High Country. He argues that in order to share space with wild plants and animals, we have no choice but to shrink our footprint and stop our ceaseless consumption of the plant's resources. He asks, can humans truly coexist with nature? We are also putting shows together next week about Bernie Sanders' economic plans, and we'll be talking about whose interests interests are represented in state government. We're talking about California specifically. There are a lot of lobbyists in Sacramento, and we'll be talking about how much power they have. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it is our media roundtable, and we are joined by Will Bunch, senior writer with the Philadelphia Daily News and author of the new ebook, The Byrne Identity, A Search for Bernie Sanders and the New American Dream. You can find more information about it at yourcallradio.org. Andrew Coburn is Washington editor of Harper's Magazine and author of Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. And here we are talking about corruption in Brazil at a time when so many people believe that money has completely corrupted the American system. And Andrew, your latest piece for Harper's takes a look at the election industrial complex. And you write about the strategists, pollsters, TV ad makers, media buyers, direct mail specialists. The list goes on. These people make a killing every election year, but do we really know who they are?
Well, yes, it's fairly, you know, they. We know who quite a few of them are. I mean, some of them become sort of stars, some of them notoriously so, like Mike Murphy, who ran Jeb Bush's super PAC, Right to Rise, and seems to have consumed something approaching $100 million and got absolutely nowhere, at least politically. Personally, may have done quite well out of it. I think people don't think of it, you know. I was trying to explain or make the case that, you know, elections are a business, and the business does very well regardless of who wins or loses. And in fact, the interests of this business are rather different from those of the candidates. I mean, the candidates want to win. The business, the election industrial complex, wants to make money, and does. And, you know, and you can see that, you know, where its real interests lie, because they put most of the money, for example, goes on television, which there is increasing amount of evidence to show actually is not very effective in delivering what the candidates want, which is votes. So I think it's rather like the military-industrial complex, you know, which is supposed to be there to provide an effective defense and is actually there to enrich itself, and defense comes a long way later.
And so the 2012 election generated about $7 billion for this industry, an mm-hmm. all-time record, and we're expecting even more this year?
Undoubtedly, because, you know, because the laws now, you know, encourage this, and particularly with, you know, since Citizens United, with the rise of super PACs, which means that any sort of idiot billionaire who fancies himself as a political, you know, wants to take part in the political game can will find plenty of people to help him set up a super PAC and take his money. You know, we've seen this most recently with the with this kind of fading now, the effort to stop Donald Trump. I mean, they spent $35 million in Florida alone to stop him. Got, you know, as we know, absolutely nowhere. But given that the rake-off for the media buyers and so forth, for TV buys, certainly for super PACs, is around 15%. So that's, you know, I haven't done the math, but that's, you know, getting on for $4 million, you know, went straight into the pockets of a relatively limited number, because there are only a limited number of players in this, just for that one primary alone.
Will, what are your thoughts about how this is covered? Because whenever we do shows about money in politics, listeners often call in and say, can you give us a breakdown of how this money is actually spent?
That's a great question. I mean, there's a lot of misconceptions, although I will say this. I mean, one thing that really impressed me when I was spending a lot of time going to Bernie Sanders rallies and events in the fall when I was reporting my ebook, The Byrne Identity, you know, I talked to a lot of rank-and-file voters, and the number one reason, again and again, at least from an issue point of view, that I heard was bringing them out to support Bernie Sanders was this issue of money in politics, you know, not the old-fashioned bread-and-butters issues, not jobs, not education. But no, they were really angry at this notion that you know, billionaires can come in and you know, spend $25 million or more on one candidate. And it really is warping the process in strange ways. I was just thinking about that the other day, you know, with Marco Rubio's campaign. I mean, Marco Rubio turned out to be a horrible candidate. He didn't connect with voters at all. And I think in past elections, he would have dropped out of the race weeks ago. But, you know, Marco Rubio had this sugar daddy, Norman Braman, who is not a very well-known person nationally, but he's extremely well-known in Philadelphia because he was, for about a decade, owner of the Philadelphia Eagles, which in Philadelphia is, you know, being owner of the Eagles is a slightly more important job than being the mayor. So he's well known here, and he did a pretty bad job at that too. Because this one billionaire was willing to sink an endless amount of money, actually several billion, he had some other wealthy supporters too, but because these billionaires were able to sink money in Marco Rubio's campaign, he was able to last for weeks beyond, you know, the voters, message from the voters, which is that they didn't want him around. So
right, it's like Sheldon Adelson during the 2008 election. I mean, you could prop up a candidate as one person if you have the money.
Yeah, but I take a more optimistic view. It shows that, you know, everyone quivers in their shivers in their boots about the power of money. You know, this Norman Braman or Sheldon Adelson or the dreaded Koch brothers. But actually, despite all the money that was pumped into Marco Rubio, he went nowhere.
Exactly. You know,
Sheldon Adelson spent $150 million in the 2012 election and actually was remarkably, gratifyingly unsuccessful.
Here's a question then.
So I don't think we should be so obsessed by this question of money in politics, because it turns out more and more that it doesn't actually, you know, have the conclusive effect that people have said it does.
So, but how should I agree with Andrew,
and I think we're going to look back on 2016 as the year when so many notions about money in politics were kind of turned on their head. You know, I mean, we're seeing these billionaires. I mean, it's almost like they're lighting their money with a match to some degree to the impact they're having. And as Andrew was saying earlier, you know, I mean, there's also, you know, questions about how effective TV is. I mean, look at the Democratic side. Bernie Sanders has just shocked people with his ability to raise money and to have such a well-funded campaign on the backs of small donors. In the five states that voted on Tuesday, in almost all of those states, he actually outspent Hillary Clinton on TV ads, and yet those ads, I mean, you could argue they brought him up to parity with Hillary Clinton in some states like Illinois and Missouri, but they didn't put him over the top. And then and the other thing is just the fact that Bernie Sanders has been able to raise so much money from small donors. This idea that a populist appeal to what the average rank and file voter really wants to hear from a politician will get them to open their checkbook for $25, $50, $100 checks, and that can add up to more than, or at least as much as, Hillary Clinton is getting with her super PACs and maxed out donors is a pretty remarkable thing, and it could be a game changer going forward.
Well, I'd love to hear listeners on this, because how do you think the media should cover money in politics? Jeb Bush's super PAC raised $118 million, and he dropped out of the race. Marco Rubio's super PAC raised millions of dollars. He's now out. Donald Trump is getting a lot of attention because he's saying he's self-funding his campaign. But then we had Jane Mayer on a couple of weeks ago talking about her book, Dark Money, in which she exposes the Koch network, and they spent so much money across this country getting their brand of Republicans elected in state legislatures, and that has had profound effects, especially when you look at anti-choice laws, for example. So how do you think we should cover money in politics? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Andrew, I see what you're saying about how sometimes $100 million does nothing for a candidate. But in the case of Marco Rubio, he sure got endless media attention.
Well, so what? I mean, yeah, they all, the establishment was desperate to stop Donald Trump. And they tried to, you know, really, he was such a false alarm. The media, not the print and TV, you know, gave him endless coverage, talked about Marco Mentum and everything, and it meant nothing. All the money and all the sort of fawning coverage of this sort of completely pathetic sort of empty suit actually made no impression at all. I thought it was very gratifying that, again, sort of, you know, further proof of my thesis that you know, just because, you know, whoever controls the checkbook, controls the vote, just isn't so. I mean, what I go on to say in the piece is that what does work is, and the Sanders campaign is a very good example of this, is, you know, is personal communication. It's actually people, voters getting engaged, voters getting personally engaged to go and turn out. I mean, there's been some very interesting sort of academic work on this, which I know has had a huge influence on the people doing a lot of the organizing in the Sanders campaign. Mm. And I tell you, know, right, you know, in your home turf in San Francisco, Credo Action, you know, has really worked very hard and very ingeniously at developing some of these techniques. And I know that, you know, like Becky Bond, who was political director of Credo, is now working with the Sanders campaign.
Right.
And that's what works. So this, you know, it's a, you know, it's so much this obsession with money and money in politics. I mean, Jane Mayer is right that the Kochs are pretty smart and they're onto this in terms of, you know, local doing ground campaigns and grassroots organizing. That's what works. And you have a purely, you know, candidate like Rubio, who had no organization, didn't sort of really care about talking to voters, just thought if he showed up and, you know, appeared on TV a lot, that somehow it could all be, you know, he would magically be transformed into votes, just didn't happen. So I think this, in lots of ways, in many ways, this election is a very depressing one, but in lots of ways, it's very encouraging that the money isn't working.
Well, and so what are your thoughts about that, Will? What do you think about what Alexander just said about Bernie Sanders' campaign?
Well, yeah, he brings a great point, and this was something I also touched on in the Burn Identity a lot about. He mentions about the role of rallies and just getting people to show up in person and you know, hear Bernie Sanders, but also show their support in a big crowd. I think this cuts to your original question about how the press is covering these issues. Because, I mean, what I saw, especially through all of 2015, and even now to some degree, is that the big players in the mainstream media just had no idea what to make of these large crowds that Bernie Sanders was getting at his rallies. I mean, to me, it was incredibly newsworthy. I mean, I went to one rally in Boston where he had, you know, 20,000 people. It was just this like sea of humanity on a terrible night, you know, bad weather, and they all came out and packed inside this convention center and got almost no coverage of the mainstream media. And you know, the savvy Beltway reporters, like Andrew said, are, you know, still focused on the money race so much that, you know, we gauge who's a serious candidate by who's, you know, raising the most money or who's able to get the big name fundraisers lined up. Well, you know, like he said, you saw what happened on the Republican side. You know, Jeb Bush, you know, was able to get many of the big name fundraisers on the Republican side behind him in 2015. And, you know, no voters had any interest in what Jeb Bush had to say. Hmm. I mean, I've never seen less enthusiasm over, you know, a supposed major candidate than the lack of enthusiasm I saw for Jeb Bush. That, you know, there was literally no constituency for him in the Republican Party other than insiders and consultants and money people. You know, I mean, it was crazy. So I think going forward, I think the media needs to, you know, look at that if a guy is turning out 20,000 people, and you know, and this applies. This applies to some degree to Donald Trump as well, because obviously, although he tends to exaggerate his crowd sizes, but he certainly, no one can deny that he gets pretty big crowds, especially now for his rallies as well. And these are two, although they're just radically different in character, but these are two mass movements, and they really seem to just have so much more powerful than the supposed almighty dollar.
Will Bunch is a senior writer with the Philadelphia Daily News and author of the new e-book, The Burn Identity, A Search for Bernie Sanders and the New American Dream. Andrew Coburn is Washington editor of Harper's and author of Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. He's got a new piece out about the election industrial complex. And if you'd like to join us to talk about media coverage of the election, we'd love to hear from you. It's going to be a long 8 months. How do you want us to cover this election? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from TJ in Santa Clara. Hi, TJ.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking the call. A question I have regarding money in politics is, you know, someone like me, I'm a less than $100 donor to some campaigns here. And as I understand it, there's not really a public disclosure of donations below $100 unless they're bigger in the aggregate. And so what I've been wondering is, how do we know that it's actually these small donations and not actually maybe one person making a $1,000,005 donation through various front names? And that's my question. Thanks a lot.
All right, thank you.
That would be a pretty pretty amazing achievement to, I mean, to generate the, you know, if somehow, you know, all the Sanders donations, Bernie Sanders donations he's talking about are all kind of a sort of massive exercise in money laundering. I mean, I'd take my hat off to whoever is organizing that. I mean, it clearly, you know, as Will is saying, this is clearly a mass movement as reflected in all those small checks that are pouring in.
Yeah, and there's a great story over at SFIST. It's a local website. You can basically search for your neighborhood to find out how your neighbors or where your neighbors are giving money. And Bernie Sanders has the top number of donors right now, 4,069, compared to Hillary Clinton. She's number two at 3,212. Now, of course, this means that you could give 10 $20 donations. But still, Will Bunch, this is a big story. I mean, Bernie has the most donors of any candidate.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, it's funny because we, I mean, this kind of started actually in 2008, I think, with President Obama when he was a candidate in 08. He was expected to be, you know, outraised and outspent by Hillary Clinton and then by the Republicans in that race. And he also did very well in getting smaller donations. What was interesting in his case, though, was I think, you know, once the closer he got to the White House, the more he became more conventional, and he started having the fundraisers on Wall Street and started, you know, getting the support from the super PACs, which is something that he had initially suggested he might not do, and ended up getting just as involved in the whole super PAC scene as any other candidates. In Bernie Sanders, you have a different case because, I mean, he's made this the absolute, you know, rock-solid foundation of his campaign. I would be, you know, it would be shocking to see him reverse. You know, it would be almost like him changing his mind on income inequality, you know, if he changed his campaign practices. So he's really set a new template, you know. And again, to bring Donald Trump into this, Trump likewise is funding his campaign through loans that he's given himself or from, you know, small donors who, you know, are kind of taken in by his televangelist style approach, I guess, or whatever, but are all, you know, writing him checks, you know, and he's also, and we haven't really talked about this much, and it's yet another, it's probably the fifth or sixth thing we've mentioned in the show that's just upended all the conventional wisdom about money in politics is that Trump hasn't really spent a lot of money to become the front runner in the Republican race. In his case, you know, it's interesting how he and Bernie Sanders have found different formulas, but in Trump's case, it's his celebrity, you know, his appeal that he, you know, and this cuts to the media and how they cover the race, I guess, but he's able just to get so much free media time. I think somebody did a report recently calculating that his free media or quote, earned media, they called it, unquote, was worth like $2 billion, which is just staggering.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, and yet you have Bernie Sanders, who gets no earned media.
Right.
I mean, he's earned it all right, but he doesn't get it.
Right. Yes, exactly.
And yet, you know, he's getting as many votes. Almost as many. You know, it's hard what how to make sense of it. I think, you know, it's basically, actually, Trump said it. I mean, Trump is no dummy, obviously. I mean, he said, I can't remember, you might know the exact quote, but he said, where's the effect of, well, Sanders and I are feeding off the same thing. People feel ripped off. So in a way, it seems to me it's one big mass movement with a sort of healthy side and a very unhealthy side.
Well, we've got a lot of emails about money and politics. I'll just read a few and then we'll take some calls. Laura says, your guests make good points or they're mistaken with the idea that money doesn't matter in politics. They're generalizing from specific races to ignore the fact when the people running the campaign smarten up, they learn how to use social media and organize effectively. Media certainly runs the game. Rita says, I wish that some social good can come from all the money through a tax on the money spent by campaigns and put it into a program for educating adults and children about how our government actually works. That is a fantastic idea. Todd writes, I think your guests are missing the point on money and politics. It's not that we're worried about buying an election as much as what happens when you get into power. Will they do what their giver wants? The other thing about money and politics is that everyone spends all their time raising money and not talking about the issues. When someone gives a bunch of money, everybody else is forced to give in order to fight. If everybody's voice was limited to smaller amounts, then maybe politicians wouldn't focus so much on the big guys.
Yeah,
Andrew.
I'd like to address the point that Laura, I think, was the first one you read. They smarten up and start spending the money on social media. What you have to understand is they'll spend the money, or to a considerable extent, they'll spend the money which is to their own advantage. You have to get out of your head the idea that all these, the industry is solely concerned with getting their man or woman elected. That they're... there's certainly many who do think that, that's part of it. I don't want to write that off. But, they will think, first of all, of the, their bottom line. And then, just go back to TV. The bulk of the money gets spent on TV because, first of all, it's easy to do. And secondly, it is very advantageous to the bottom line of the industry. Time, and there's, overwhelming evidence to show that what really pays off is organizing on a on the ground. That's what
I do want to say this, and this is also off I guess it was Laura, the first emailer, her point. We've been focusing, just like the whole country is, we've been kind of focusing obsessively on the presidential race, but obviously there are many other elections, and it is true, because of all the media focus on the presidential attention, it may mitigate some of the focus on money. In lower races on the ballot, that may not be the case. I mean, we've seen a phenomenon in the last 5 or 10 years in this country where you've seen business interests, especially after the Citizens United ruling, spend, hundreds of thousands of dollars to elect judges to state Supreme Courts in states like West Virginia, in races where the public generally doesn't know the candidate, so TV ads for a judicial candidate when nobody even knows who the other candidates are can be incredibly valuable, and that's a phenomenon we've seen. So
well, that's true.
I mean,
if all you've got is television, and no one sort of organizes on the other side, it'll happen by default. But
I don't want to imply that 2016 has shown that money's worthless. I mean, in a race for like a judge, for example, it could be worth a lot if an interested party, a coal company, for example, wants to buy a judge. Sadly, that's still possible in this country,
And to that point, Stephen says $100 million may not be a deal maker in the presidential election, but lesser amounts have bought state legislature seats, and that has greatly influenced our lives.
Definitely.
Thank you for that. And I hope you all can tune in on Thursday, because we are going to talk about whose interests are really represented in state government, and we'll specifically focus on California. We have time for a few calls. Let's hear from Tom in Alameda. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I'm a very average voter who will be participating in a presidential election like lots of people for the first time. I wonder if you can explain to me one thing that's been gnawing at me watching the major network TV. While the two most exciting campaigns are fueled by angry middle-class white people on one side supporting Trump and angry working-class, mostly young people on Bernie's side, what I see the pundit class in the established media keep wanting to write off the lesser-funded candidates. I saw the last primaries, and they kept using the word Hillary sweep, even though in many states I see Bernie and Hillary just separated by a hair's thin margin, and the delegates are supposed to be proportional. What explains this tendency for the talking heads on major media like Gloria Borger, Chuck Todd, all these talking heads? They keep using the word sweep when clearly it's not.
Mm. Yeah, good question. Will, do you want to take that first?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I certainly had that same thought to some degree Tuesday night. A couple things regarding Hillary versus Bernie in that election. First of all, if you go back 8-9 months, people thought Bernie Sanders was just going to be blown out of the water coast to coast, you know, that he had, nobody knew who he was. He was running against the powerful Hillary Clinton. And, you know, here he is running in the state of Illinois, you know, the state where Hillary Clinton was born and grew up, you know, for example. And the race is 51% to 49% or less, I think. It was even closer than that. And I think they actually won either the same number of delegates or one or the other one more delegate. And yet, because of, you know, the tendency of the media to cover it as a horse race, you know, we're covering it like it's March Madness or the NCAA. It's like who won or who lost when there's other things going on. There's a race for delegates and there's a race for, you know, respect and momentum. And you know, I mean, some people kind of scoffed when Bernie Sanders said in his speech that we exceeded expectations, but he did actually exceed expectations on Tuesday. But, you know, the media found its storyline and it was the 5-for-5 sweep and there you go.
And I thought it was telling, Andrew, I heard a reporter on ABC say that when she went down to the South, she met people who really didn't know anything about Bernie. They barely even heard of the guy.
Right.
And that's right, because the establishment, which, you know, the complex, doesn't like him. It doesn't really know what to make of him. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, Trump, they can sort of, well, they sort of learning to deal with him. And he, after all, is a professional, basically what he is or has been is a professional TV entertainer, so you know he's part of the game. But Sanders is from so outside their experience. I remember years ago when Bernie Sanders first got into the Senate. I think it was someone on ABC actually saying, but he was going through the results on election night, and he said, "And believe it or not, the people of Vermont have actually elected a socialist to the Senate." He was laughing. You know, this was so outlandish. You know, shows what weird people they are there.
Well, we will definitely continue covering this. Andrew Coburn is Washington editor of Harper's Magazine and author of Kill Chain. Will Bunch is senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News and author of the new ebook, The Burn Identity. Andrew and Will, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Rose. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with environmental journalist Jason Mark about his new book, Satellites in the High Country, Searching for the Wild in the Age of Man. Mark argues that in order to share space with wild plants and animals, we must shrink our footprint and stop our ceaseless consumption of the planet's resources. Can humans truly coexist with nature? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.